Hello and welcome to the Ship Energy Podcast with me, Ariane Morrissey. This week, we're asking what a sound approach to the transition to new fuels can look like in practice for shipping companies. This is a complex question, and to tackle it, I'm joined by Daniel Gent, who, after 18 years at United European Car Carriers, UECC, first in fuel purchasing and then as energy and sustainability manager, has now moved on to lead the marine fuels transition for Sawyer Group, which partly owns UECC in addition to Wallenius Wilhelmsen and Wallenius Sol. Welcome to the podcast, Dan.
Thanks for having me, Ariane.
So first things first, fleshing out a strategy for a transition to new marine fuels is a complex task to begin with. And we know that the shipping companies under the Sawyer Group have very different routes, very different markets. What will be the common denominators for your approach?
When it comes to the common denominators, it's the challenges that exist for all of the companies, whether within our group or whether they're in the shipping industry in general. They're largely universal challenges. I mean, we have challenges faced around regulation, fuel availability, certification, cost, data. You know, they're all the same challenges that we have to face. That the difference is the kind of the uniqueness of our own trading profiles, and that I think is where it's important that each company has the ability to be able to look at what they do and see what fits best within this operational profile that I have. But there are common learnings that you can have across all of those things that I just mentioned, which are applicable to all companies, regardless of their trading patterns, region, and so on.
And what are those learnings, for example?
Well, I think you need to understand that if you have a company which is well exposed to EU sailing, then of course you have greater EU regulation obligations. So that's going to inform which fuels might be more applicable to you. And if you're looking within the EU, then certain fuels are recognised, like negative carbon intensity biomethane, which are not necessarily recognised on a global level. So if you're operating between West Africa and South America, probably you're not going to be as interested in the negative carbon intensity fuels because there isn't the regulatory framework to recognize that yet. But then you also get into looking at the fuel availability where you are. And what we're seeing, again, in Europe is that there is a very good, well-connected gas grid network and the ability to pull gas, a mass balanced gas across the grid. So, of course, that's going to help to inform which fuels you're likely to choose. So I think they're the main things that you would look at are how exposed you are to regulations and what fuels are available. And then you get into the next levels of sort of certification. So can the suppliers that you have within your routes deliver you with the right fuels to be deliver the CO2 emission reductions in a recognized way that benefits your operation?
And are there any types of companies or any types of routes where that transition to new fuels can be easier or more complicated?
Yeah, of course. I think one of the reasons we've had good success within UECC in my previous position, but also in general, if you look across the container line of business, you look across the Ro-Ro line of business, if you look at any liner sort of service, it's easier to build supply chain because you know where you're going to call, you know how frequently you're going to call there. So of course that makes things, it breaks down one of the barriers, which is uncertainty of trading patterns, which is something that, for example, tramp bulk operators or liquid tankers have an issue with, because you don't necessarily know where your vessel is going to trade, where it's going to operate, and that naturally is going to narrow the scope of which fuels you may have access to. You're also going to have the ability to or lack of ability to use one fuel in one port and know that you can get the same batch of fuel elsewhere. So I think there are natural issues that occur when you are not trading in a set route like you do with a liner service. So that's one of the main things. But I guess the key differentiator here is how companies organize themselves to tackle those nuances within their own businesses. It's not necessarily about exactly which fuel they pick. I mean, they're quite broad churches here, whether it's biofuels is a very broad label. So biofuels can cover most shipping companies' demands one way or the other. But the question is about choosing exactly which biofuel is going to work, where do you want to take it, which vessels should receive it, and what engines you have on board and all of this kind of thing.
Now, looking at your mandate for the Sawyer Group, I'm kind of curious to hear more about the level of ambition and your vision there. Because when you were appointed, you said that Sawyer Group has an ambition to pioneer sustainable fuel solutions for the maritime sector. But is your vision compliance-based, or are you planning to go beyond regulatory requirements?
Well, I think first of all, just to say that, you know, I think there is a real danger that shipping industries in the kind of decarbonisation mission become isolated in the way they try to optimize. You know, the last thing that we need is shipping companies going down their own optimization pathways as islands from one another. Because, as I say, there are lots of common learnings. There's also lots of benefits in sharing of not only knowledge, but also sharing of purchasing together. Because you have the ability to start to scale up supply when you can go as a unified entity towards the industry, towards the supply industry. So I think first and foremost, there is a really big need for leadership in this space, for transparency and for collaboration. And I think that's some of the founding principles of the idea at Sawyer. So to come on to your question directly about whether this is compliance driven, I think it's really, really important that we explain that regulation can't set the demand for alternative fuels. We can't, you know, we cannot be driven by the regulation to what the demand for alternative fuel is. We have to go beyond that. You know, we've always maintained within our organization in UECC and Sawyer that, you know, compliance with regulation is compliance with the law. It's not really something to be proud of to say that you are compliant with a regulation. What you need to do is go beyond that level. So what we try to do here is to be able to, yes, aggregate demand. It's to try to bring different shipping companies together where we can learn transparently from one another, and then also share those learnings that we've had over the last, you know, 18 years in my case in UECC. To be able to go way beyond the regulation and start to send market signals to the supply side that here we have a really clear group of shipping companies that are interested to increase the use of alternative fuel exponentially. So I think the real value comes from integrating those fuels as alternative fuels, bringing them into your commercial and operational strategy, not just looking at alternative fuels as a compliance tool. They're much, much more than that. And that's one of the key things that we did in UECC, was that we were able to unlock the value of alternative fuels, which meant that we could go far beyond just meeting requirements, you know, basic compliance with the law. And when we look in the long term here, our idea, our belief, the long term winners on this journey are those that learn the fastest. And it's not about waiting for the perfect rules to appear. I think that's the key thing to understand. You need to move ahead of that.
And you talk about exploring different alternative fuels. Do you have any plans to explore ammonia, methanol, hydrogen, for example, or are you going to focus on LNG and biofuels for the time being?
Yeah, I think what you have is you have all fuels need to be taken on their merits. And I think you have real issues with certain fuels. If we look at ammonia, for example, there are safety concerns that's still not being fully addressed. But also there are some fundamental structural questions that need to be addressed around the availability of renewable energy. You know, and that's a common issue for all e-fuels, actually, is how do you get e-fuels supplied into to the shipping industry when there is already a shortage of renewable energy and there is massive demand for it elsewhere in other sectors. Bio-LNG, I mean, LNG obviously has been a good transitional sort of fuel. I mean, my personal belief is, and this is the way that I've communicated with in my last position, is that we're entering the post-LNG era, actually. Shipping companies should be considering that, you know, especially those who adopted LNG early like we did, should be considering that we're moving beyond LNG now, and we're looking obviously to bio-LNG. Methanol also has an interesting case, but it's in my opinion, it's a lesser version of LNG. So the question becomes, how can you source biomethanol that can compete, or that is structurally can work better than bio-LNG? So all fuels are kind of taken on the merits, but there are clear issues with some fuels, which mean that they're, I would say, if not off the table, certainly very, very far down the pecking order.
I'd like to go back to a point you mentioned about having to go beyond regulatory requirements, because the timing of your appointment might sound a bit surprising, because we've seen many companies adopt a sit back and wait approach due to the uncertainty around the IMO net zero framework. So why is Soya Group taking this step now?
Yeah, it's a valid question. I think the easiest answer is that sit back and wait is exactly the risk. That's actually the risk that the industry faces. I mean, if doing nothing is causing two problems. One, we're not getting anywhere near the climate targets, and we're making nowhere near enough steps towards meeting the climate targets that have been set. The second thing that happens when you sit back and wait is that a knowledge gap starts to grow. And what I mean by that is you have ship owners who are potentially willing to decarbonize and are interested to do it, but they don't necessarily understand or have all of the tools in their arsenal to be able to take the first steps on that sort of journey to bring in alternative fuels. And when they see that the industry is sit back and wait approach, it tends that the supply side doesn't get the demand signals. The suppliers are not getting the demand signals that the industry wants these fuels, and then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy that the industry is sitting back and waiting for something to happen, and the suppliers are not bringing some fuel that isn't apparently in demand. And so what happens is you end up with a situation where EU regulation, potentially global regulation, financiers who have their own requirements for financing projects like new ships, charterers potentially, are the ones who shape behavior. And that's something you want to really avoid. You don't want to have behavior shaped by the regulation. You would rather have sort of thought leadership. So in our vision here, it's about building capability ahead of the obligation. So you need to start to build up that demand for alternative fuels before there is a requirement for it, actually. And then in doing so, you can start to really have a very sharp uptake in alternative fuels across the shipping sector. If I look at UECC, you know, our ambitions to have 40% alternative fuel mix in our overall energy portfolio by 2025, originally the target was 2030. And then actually we were finding such a success with bringing alternative fuels in that we achieved it 5 years ahead of time. So I think that's a really key point here, is that to any ship owners who still believe that sit back and wait is the best strategy, you know, engage with those who've been on this journey already, actually, like ourselves, and see how you can bring alternative fuels into your operation.
You mentioned the case of UECC just now, which is actually quite interesting because it's a mid-sized company which can reflect the challenges and reality of many others in the industry. And you mentioned just now that you've achieved your target for the integration of alternative fuels in the fuel mix 5 years ahead of time. How did you do it? What were the main learnings that perhaps could apply to other companies?
Yeah, well, I think on that one we had a head start because we had LNG vessels, the first LNG car carriers in the world. Again, this is coming from the leadership of the owners, which of course in UECC is MYK and Wallenius Lines as part of Soya Group. So when you have that sort of leadership coming from the board, we took a very, you know, what was seen at the time, a very bold step to order some LNG car carriers I was involved in the project back in 2013-14. We made the decision to build them. So it seems a lifetime ago now. And the first vessels were delivered in 2016-17. And since then, we've gone on to order another three. So there's five vessels in operation there with more to come in the next couple of years. The reason I mentioned that is that LNG enabled a real emission reduction and sort of set us on the pathway, but it wasn't a silver bullet. It was the sort of foundation that was then needed to be built upon. Biofuels came in to deal with, as I would call it, the legacy tonnage, those older vessels where retrofitting doesn't make sense and they're probably too old to, or not old enough to be able to phase out and bring new vessels in, but too old to really warrant doing anything, any major capex investment on. So the biofuels works very well operationally for those vessels, but you had to, yeah, certification and consistency were much harder than expected, I would say, to achieve, because again, we introduced biofuels in 2020. So that's again ahead of the curve really there. And I think what I would say is the the really important learning for me was that when you introduce a pilot, be it residual biofuels, be it LNG, be it bio-LNG, be it cashew nutshell liquid, as we've used quite successfully in the fleet as well, these pilots only matter and they only work if they generate repeatable learning. So if they generate something which you can copy and paste, replicate into sister vessels, or you can take some of them and apply it to other shipping companies potentially as well. I think one of the biggest mistakes or the biggest learnings as well is that you underestimate the demands of administration and data when it comes to alternative fuels, because it's all very well to go ahead and buy this fuel and that fuel, but what you need to really understand is how do we, when you burn the fuel and it still emits CO2, right? Biofuels emit CO2. They're still carbon-based fuels. So when you emit CO2, you need to find a way that you get the recognition for that as a renewable fuel. And that's all on paper. It's all documentary. It's not physical. And I think that's one thing that shipping companies definitely need a hand with. And we'll have seen that. I'm sure there are plenty of shipping companies out there that hear this, that will understand that through Fuelio Maritime, where they've introduced alternative fuels. And the challenge is in getting the right documentation, the right proof sustainability for the fuels that you've used to be able to unlock that value. So I think they're some of the big learnings. Do's and don'ts, I would say start early. Do is start early. Test, measure, and learn from it. I think that's certainly what we did with the cashew nutshell liquid. Nobody else was really doing it. We found a very controlled environment in which we could do it and took a very, very slow phased approach to bringing this fuel in, starting with lab tests, shore engine tests, and then very limited tests on board the vessel until we had full operation. Invest in internal understanding. So make sure that you have the right resources internally to be able to handle the complex administrative needs that sustainability requires. You know, I talk about this a lot with sustainability departments, is that there is perhaps unfairly sustainability departments get maligned as a sort of kumbaya, holding hands in a circle, trying to make the world a better place. And I think it's unfair of the modern sustainability department, who actually have a really important role to play in not hindering the growth of the business, but in decoupling the growth of the business from the environmental impact. So your job as a sustainability department is to build the resources internally so the business can continue to flourish and the environmental impact of your operations can reduce. The big don'ts, I would say, don't wait for the perfect regulation or the perfect fuel. It won't come. It won't appear. And what will happen will be, while you're sitting and waiting, somebody else will take the lead on sourcing this fuel or that fuel, or they will get ahead of the regulation and then be in a stronger position on the kind of competitive playing field. I think they're the biggest do's and don'ts.
In commercial terms, though, are ship owners who do use alternative fuels on their fleets being rewarded for their efforts? In other words, does that make sense in commercial terms and business terms today?
Yeah, I think the simplest answer there is that not consistently. I don't think first moves have been rewarded commercially consistently yet. I think it's unfortunately it depends a lot on your customer base, for example. So, you know, in the case of a car carrier business, you're much more likely to have great support from your car manufacturers, who are your customers, as UECC has enjoyed through its relationships with its customers. We had the Sail for Change program, which was a Scope 3 emission reduction program. It's much easier to roll out alternative fuels when you have customers who are prepared to invest in the decarbonization product that you're offering. That's difficult if you're an owner, especially if you're an owner of a shipping company that charters out vessels and are operating on tramp basis by charterers, potentially even voyage charterers. There isn't a great incentive for those voyage charterers to want to introduce alternative fuels. So it's very hard for you as an owner to be able to be rewarded commercially by providing a sort of a more sustainable operation. I think the benefits today are for many companies seen as more strategic than financial. You know, you have a greater credibility. You're seen as being more capable From a risk management perspective, I think you have, I think you're seen as a safer bet if you are prepared for the future. I think that's one of the benefits that you can have if you're a first mover. You know, externally, people realize that you are a forward thinker, which is good. But all of those benefits, the credibility and the capability, these advantages compound over time. So, and what I mean by that is UECC was already well along the journey to introducing alternative fuels before any customers came to support the alternative fuel program that we had. And what that meant was that the point at which the customers came on board, they came on board because we were credible. They came on board because they understood that this is a shipping company who is using alternative fuels, understands how to introduce them, has been doing it for a while. If any shipping company is going to be the one that we'll buy emissions reductions from, it would be UECC. So I think, although they're not necessarily immediately financial in the beginning, you build a baseline of kind of credibility in the market, which then will then invite others to you know, customers to come and get on board with you.
Interesting, because in the whole debate on decarbonization, it's often pitted as two sides. So the quote pragmatics and versus, you know, the pioneers or ambitious, so
dreamers.
Yeah, and so if I hear what you're saying, essentially the two are not necessarily incompatible.
No, absolutely not. I think it's pragmatic to be prepared. I think it's pragmatic to introduce alternative fuels, because our vessels are built to operate for, you know, a generation. I mean, they're built to operate for 20, 25, 30 plus years, depending on the type of vessel. So when you make an investment decision, you're not making an investment decision to compete and operate today. Of course, that's part of your decision, as part of your thinking. But you also need to be thinking much further ahead. And I think that testing and understanding alternative fuels, investing in optionality on vessels, I think is always a very smart bet, because it sets you very well for the future. And as we see now, Fulia Maritime is a fantastic example of this. What's happened in the last year is that those companies who invested in alternative fuels are now actually being rewarded, because shipping companies which are not able to comply with the regulation are entering contracts with those who exceed the regulation, and the financial reward is there. So this it's not going to go backwards. Let's put it that way. These trends that we see, where the ones willing to invest and the ones who are willing to explore new fuels and bringing alternative fuels into the fleets are rewarded, that's going to happen more and more in the years to come. So there's really no reason to think that being pragmatic is doing nothing. I think quite the opposite.
Thank you very much, Dan.